When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Hey there, and welcome back to Candidate Confessional. I'm your host, Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And Jason, today we're going to talk about Jeb Bush, John Ellis Bush, who, when he launched his run for the White House in 2016, was a juggernaut. You know, this is an establishment figure, raised tons of cash, he had connections in the party, and certainly had the wherewithal to run a campaign.
But he ended up being a gaffe machine. That was like his reliable thing that he would do every day.
24/7.
Screw up.
There's an ad promoting Supergirl. She looked pretty hot.
You find a Democrat that's for cutting taxes, cutting spending $10? I'll give him a warm kiss.
That we're prepared to act in the national security interests of this country to get back in the business of creating a more peaceful world. Please clap.
And see, by the end of the campaign, it almost appeared like Donald Trump had established a permanent residency in Jeb's head, paying property taxes and renting out the basement apartment.
It was quite the English basement, Sam.
Oh, yeah, beautiful windows.
Donald looked comfortable there.
but what the media saw was far different than what Jeb's own staff was observing.
Tim Miller, who's our guest on today's podcast and who served as his communications director, grew to deeply appreciate Jeb during the campaign, but he also recognized that his candidate was... It wasn't the gaffes that were messing him up.
No.
It was something else.
No, it wasn't the awkward hoodie. It wasn't the bumbling jokes or the please clap lines. It wasn't even the debate performances or, I would say, even the presence of Trump, really. No, what Tim understood was that Jeb was kind of unfit for the modern Republican Party, and a lot of it, really, all of it, was about that last name.
Beyond the bluster.
Behind the bunting.
Past the posters.
After the ads.
The campaign picks up.
And the motorcade moves on.
What happens when the votes are counted?
And democracy doesn't go your way.
This is Candidate Confessional, a HuffPost podcast.
I'm Sam Stein. Okay. I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Cherkis.
And we approve this podcast.
If you hear a clinging sound in the background, Tim, as a condition for coming on this program, demanded that I make him Bloody Marys. So we're drinking Bloody Marys, and I think it's like, what, 11:15, which is totally acceptable.
Yeah, completely appropriate.
Yeah, okay, so cheers.
Well, it's like a brunch.
It's a brunch.
It's post-campaign.
Yeah.
World, right? Well, no, I mean, it's kind of late staying for drinking.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so we're going to talk about the Jeb campaign. And I want to start with... why you decided to sign on board, and what was the pitch that he made to you? Because I know, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, you had, you know, a fair number of offers and opportunities to do things in the cycle, and you chose Jeb. So how did that come to be?
Well, for me, in the end, it ended up being a no-brainer. Not, you know, you're going to make me start off being all nice and soft and bubbly about Jeb and how much I love him, but I do. I didn't know Jeb at all, you know, and I went and talked to, you know, a number of the candidates. I wanted to do another campaign. I had done the Huntsman campaign in 2012. That obviously didn't end as we had hoped. So I wanted to try to have a better result this time. And, you know, the reality was, to me, there was no real competition in the field. Jeb was just so clearly the person that was best suited to be president.
Yeah, but take us in the room as he talks to you and says, I want you to work for me. What's the pitch he gives you?
Sure. Well, I flew to Tallahassee. Which is about as expensive and time-consuming as flying to Greece. It is very challenging to get to Tallahassee.
No direct flights.
It took 17 hours, and I believe cost $1,342 to Jeb Bush's leadership pack. So I had a lot of time to think about it, and I gained a lot of nerves. I had to get there a day early because of the lengthy travel. I stayed at a beautiful, Ramada Inn. I woke up, as you do, with a big interview day, nervous. And so I woke up maybe about an hour and a half before the interview was maybe at 9. I was up at 7. And I at 8 o'clock I turned on my Uber to no Ubers. I called at I started to get in a panic at 8:05. I called a cab company. The cab company said we'll be there in 45 minutes to an hour. Then I got into an extreme panic and walked out onto the street and just and as I was about to like literally start walking. To go to this interview, I'm sweating. Another cab pulls into the hotel and looks at me and says, "Josh." And I was like, "Yep, you got it." Got into the cab and took it to go interview Jeb. So apologies to whoever's cab I stole in Tallahassee that day. And then look, I mean, the pitch that Jeb made was honestly pretty straightforward. You know, what he offered was the fact that he had a vision for the kind of campaign he wanted to run and the kind of president he wanted to be that was very clear. And, you know, without selling out any of the other candidates I talked to, that wasn't the case for everybody. A lot of people run for president because they want to run for president, and that's really the reason why. What he asked me was what he recognized in that first interview is he said that the things that he was the most worried about running was the dynasty issue and how he could get around it. And so we spent a lot of time kind of talking about
that. We'll get to that. But how much of it was like just you wanting to hitch your wagon to a winner? I mean, that had to play a role. And he seemed at that point to be the most likely to win.
Boy, I thought it was really wide open. I mean, yeah, it seemed like there definitely was an element of it that you wanted to be with, somebody that was going to be in the mix. I mean, part of the problem with Huntsman was like we weren't even really in the mix. It wasn't just that we didn't win, but there were huge portions of the campaign where we weren't really even relevant to kind of like the conversation. And so the fact that Jeb was always going to be in the mix did play a role. But yeah, honestly, at that time, like who knew, right?
People like you probably envision, standing behind that lectern at the White House briefing room.
I do not.
And you're like, I want the best opportunity to be there, right?
No, I told Michael Steele with an E, not Michael Steele you had on the show.
This is John Boehner's former press secretary.
He was much better suited for sitting behind the lectern, as you'll hear over the next however long this podcast ends up being after being cut. I'm not very well suited to the messaging discipline that would be required. And I also, you won't know this because you can't see my face, but I'm a horrendous poker player. You know exactly what I'm thinking about you when you ask me a question. If you ask a stupid question, you know. So those are not skills well suited. But honestly, it mattered that I thought that he had a good chance to win. But that being said, it was at the beginning of this race, it was really much more wide open than people realize.
There seemed to be also, from a strategic standpoint, this idea that you were going to like overwhelm the competition really early on, right? You're going to raise a ton of money. You're getting all these endorsements. You're not going to let any of the candidates even, get into the race. You're going to try to elbow them out. And to a certain extent, that's kind of like a double-edged sword, right? I mean, like, you're inevitable on one hand, but then you have like a huge target on your back. And when those candidates do enter the race, suddenly you're the establishment guy that they're trying to pick off.
Well, look, yes, that's true. That there's a pluses and minuses that go with that. On the other hand, we were a Bush, and his name is Jeb Bush. So we were going to have the target on our back regardless. Like this idea that, he was going to be able to kind of like hide in the weeds until January and have this late surge as, George Bush's brother and son was would probably not have been a strategy that was realistic.
The idea here is that, with the last name Bush, there are certain limitations on what type of candidate you can be. I mean, I think that's sort of the general theme. And so I guess the question I have is, did you ever have a serious discussion in the campaign about changing his last name? Maybe like go with like Lincoln or
my
something.
My mother suggested could he go take his wife's name? It would appeal to women and Hispanics. Jeb Garnica de Gallo. I did not raise that idea with him. I thought it was I thought my mother brought kind of a nice outsider point of view there.
Yeah,
but
he hired the wrong person in the family.
I don't know that would have. I don't know that maybe we could have survived that without some mockery.
But and then all seriousness though. But like, what were the early conversations about how to handle the legacy issue?
I think that. The initial case, I'm trying to put my head back in the space of whatever, March of 2015, but, the initial idea was that we needed to, you know, introduce Jeb as Jeb and tell Jeb's story, right? And so I think we got criticized a lot during the campaign about kind of talking about the past, right? Not talking enough about the future, talking about his time as governor and the in Florida. But, you know, we felt like we needed to do that to, you know, as to tell the Jeb story, to make a unique case for Jeb. You know, another thing that we did and we're mindful of is to not run a campaign that seemed entitled, right? And I think that the what part of the tension about what you were talking about earlier, Sam, with this sort of shock and awe, you know, effort, is that there were elements of that that did come
like
off
the
that way.
Is yours,
yeah, there, yeah. And that was never, you know, really kind of intentional what we said, but I think it did send off that message. But you know, on the flip side, you know, it's not like we weren't going to try to raise as much money and get as many endorsements as we could, right? But I mean, that's sort of, you know, what the whole object of these campaigns. But, you know, if you looked at the types of events we did and the type of, you know, they were not, you know, really big, well-produced affairs, right? You know, Jeb was really easy to get to. You know, if you came out on the road with him and you were a reporter or a human, you could ask him a question very easily. We did kind of self-deprecating videos at the start, which were really funny.
And there's a thing called Sharknado. And I think I see Ann Coulter as Vice President of the United States. It's kind of weird. And there's sharks coming out of the sky. People are getting killed. The White House is being collapsed.
And made Jeb seem human. And then, you know, sort of towards the end of the campaign, maybe had a different kind of feel to them. But
was that all by design?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we were very conscious of the fact that, you know, we did not want this to seem in any way like a Rose Garden kind of campaign, that Jeb needed to, you know, in some ways humble, you know, himself to demonstrate to voters that he was going to go out and earn it, in addition to, you know, kind of telling, you know, this Jeb story and what was different about his life and his life experience than his brother and his dad.
But it wasn't just the last name, right? I mean, like, the Iraq War became the first big sort of policy problem that you faced.
Knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
I would have, and so would have Hillary Clinton.
It still is kind of unclear, like either he kind of misheard the question, or I think that what really happened was he knew what, like, kind of what question was coming, and he had his talking points ready, and so he didn't hear the exact way that she phrased it. But the fact that he said "I would" right away kind of led to a, you know, media frenzy about whether, knowing what we know now, you know, he would go back into Iraq, which then kind of led to a tortured, like, 3 or 4 days where we had to, you know, talk about what that meant in every different iteration of, about how he felt about the Iraq War. And I think that to your point, that sort of encapsulates, you know, kind of the issue, is that we had to talk about that in depth, in a detail that nobody else had to, right? Like,
no.
Marco was never asked, you know, in any
sort
of...
Well, everyone was asked after that.
Right.
But it was like a 2-minute story, and they had... Because he had gone first, they all were able to, like, tailor their answers.
And they didn't have the complication of their brother.
Correct.
And did... I mean, would you guys prepare for that question ahead of time? Do you guys know that... Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, what he said was... I'd have to go back and look at the transcript, but if you look at what he said outside of the... You know, the exact way that Megyn Kelly framed the question, what he said was exactly what, you know, he had prepared to say and what he ended up saying, which was basically, obviously there are mistakes, you know, there were there were elements of the strategy that didn't go well,
sure,
but the surge worked.
But when you're behind the scenes and you're handling communication strategy, sure, walk us through how you come to a realization that an answer like that is a problem. Like, did you know in the moment?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was taped.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was taped earlier in the day at Liberty. So we knew in the moment. And I called Megyn, and I think we tried to decide, at that time we tried to decide what, you know, whether we needed to correct it before, like, it aired, you know, or, you know, and what we sort of had decided was that, you know, maybe Megyn could kind of explain it. So we knew it was a problem.
Did you recognize how big a problem?
No. And I think that's why we didn't correct it in the show, right?
Yeah.
And that's why we didn't correct it in the show.
When you guys called Megyn Kelly, was she open to help it?
Like, she understood. I mean, she agreed. That's how she, you know, how she interpreted his answer was exactly how he intended it, which was basically to say, I would go into Iraq knowing everything that I know now, but I think that on balance, going into Iraq was good, and there were mistakes, and here are the things we should have done differently. So, you know, the issue was then, because he put himself in that situation where he had said, I would, then, you know, he needed to go out and explicitly say, I wouldn't, right? And then that goes to my point, where none of the other candidates ever really had to say that, like, I wouldn't. And so in the series of interviews after, I think we did Hannity, and then I forget what he did after that.
It's sort of, you're bringing up like an interesting problem. Like, you started out wanting to run kind of a humble campaign. You wanted to earn it. You staged events that were sort of smaller.
For the record, Tim's taking a massive gulp of Bloody Mary well, after this.
More Iraq questions.
We have photos of you
Can we
protesting.
Talk about Chertoff?
Katrina's next, don't worry.
But you have this tension where you want to run sort of a humble campaign. You want to be accessible. You want to do events where he has to earn it. He's meeting voters. He's not flying into different airport hangars and then leaving. And then he's getting questions about, you know, the legacy questions, all these issues around the Iraq War, and they're more complicated than if, say, Rubio got them. That seemed to be an overriding tension throughout the race. Was this his desire to just run as Jeb and then these other questions?
Yeah. I mean, look, and there were some things, and this is going back to our first conversation, that, you know, there were some advantages to it, right? Like, we got attention in a way that other candidates didn't. And so what we tried to do was, you know, use that to our advantage and kind of ride that, you know, ride that wave. I mean, much more at the beginning of the campaign, you know, any time we did anything, you know, it garnered a lot more media coverage. And that's why I think we felt at the start something that kind of looks obviously wrong in retrospect was that we could create a Jeb versus Trump binary, because in kind of the media environment, we were able to do that because we were the only people they're interested in talking to. So, you know, that's how we tried to turn that that tension into a positive. But it was obviously, you know, the negative side was, that are pretty obvious.
Was one of the problems that you had that was talked about in the moment, I think Ben Smith, among others, was writing about this, that he had been off the trail so long and hadn't really been involved in electoral politics that he had, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, that he was a little rusty.
Yeah, I mean, look, Ben's article, and I think other people wrote this, were basically that, you know, he had run his last campaign in 2002.
Yeah.
You know, so this was...
So we're talking like 13 years.
Pre-Twitter.
Far pre-Twitter, pre-YouTube, pre-blogs. You know what I mean? Like, there was still, you know, there was cable, but, you know,
MySpace.
Kind of, was MySpace rounded up too?
I just made that up. I have no idea.
I'm trying to remember how old
maybe
was
the
I in
first, maybe the first MySpace maybe pages the first were popping up there, yeah.
Used MySpace in a very innovative way.
Yeah, I'm
sure he did.
No, there were kind of elements of this that we wanted to talk about his, because he was kind of, they called him the e-governor, and he was kind of innovative in this regard, and he was the first state that had like a website where you could file your complaints or issues onto the website. Florida's the first state to do this, but all of the examples we came up with seemed kind of ridiculous and antiquated in retrospect, so we weren't able to use that. So in that sense, you know, I think Ben was right. Look, I think there were two elements to it. One is he was very easy. It was very easy to kind of get up to speed on the tools of the campaign. Like, none of this stuff is rocket science, right? So that was less the issue, as I do feel like Marco and Ted and, you know, even people who didn't do as well, like Bobby Jindal and Walker, you know, they sort of grew up in this kind of media environment where they'd been burned before and they'd been bitten by, you know, this sort of 24-hour media environment where, you know, if Jeb, you know, kind of made a gaffe or whatever back in 2002, like Adam Smith wrote a story for the Tampa Bay Times the next day and then it was over, right? So he was able to kind of weather those. And he didn't kind of build up that kind of alligator skin that Marco has. So
did it shock him when he?
No, I don't know. No, he didn't. It didn't faze him at all because he didn't really read it. You know, I mean, he didn't.
So then what did it matter?
It mattered in the sense of, you know, I think that if you look at Marco or Ted or some of these other guys, for better or worse, they had built up an ability to deal with this by being boring. You know, by repeating the same things over and over again. Like, this is something that Jeb didn't like to do. And so, you know, that came naturally to Marco. He was schooled in it. He came up in 2010. And in the end, it ended up kind of hurting him.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan,
turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
What was the first inclination that Mr. Donald J. Trump was going to be a force to be reckoned with?
For us, for Jeb, it happened, I think, earlier than for everybody else because he was relentless in the way that he was attacking Jeb. And he was doing it in a way that was outside of, you know, political norms, right? I mean, just the types of attacks that he was delivering then that got you guys interested, right? Not you two necessarily in particular, but
no,
the media.
I was interested.
You were interested too, right? Yeah. So, look, I think that there was a sense for us, and this was a much shorter period than people realize, at the start where, and I will, you know, raise my hand, guilty as charged on this, where I thought that the right thing to do is ignore him. You know, that this was a joke. He was trying to get a lot of attention, that if we get down in the mud with him, that... we're never going to get out, and we're going to spend every day talking about him.
Was there someone on your team that had the opposite viewpoint?
Yeah, well, there were people right from the start. You know, but this period of time is like we're literally talking 3 weeks where this sort of discussion was happening. And then it became, I think, universally clear that we had to respond to him when, one, this was the 4th of July weekend, he said that Jeb was for immigration reform because his wife was a Mexican.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, you can't let kind of an attack on your wife go by, for political reasons, but also just kind of moral reasons. You have to stand up for your wife. And then it was the next week, I believe, it was the state fair. And he lands at the state fair in Iowa and he has this huge press conference. And the whole press conference is about Jeb. And they ask him about, whatever healthcare policy, and he'd say, Jeb's in the pocket of the lobbyists and the DC politicians, and Jeb's just in the big donors' pockets, and he's low energy, and his wife's a Mexican, and I remember sitting there in my apartment, because this was on a weekend, watching the live stream of it, and thinking, okay, like this is like we can't just say nothing, right? Like the idea that we are going to ignore him and he's going to go away. Was not really a choice for us, and it was the next week in New Hampshire where Jeb, went out and started punching back.
Was it more than just a strategic consideration? Was it an emotional consideration? Were you like, this guy's a fucking asshole? Like, I can't believe he's doing this, and I really, really, really want to hit back at him.
No, it was strategic consideration. I mean, he is an asshole. That's true.
Sure.
There was not an emotional kind of. Well,
I just feel like
maybe there was for right. somebody.
I'm just curious, like, what was Jeb's initial reaction to Trump, and what was his feeling? Where did he come down on the debate early on?
I think initially he was on the side of, I can't spend my whole campaign is going to be consumed by talking about Trump, right? If I start responding to every time he says something crazy about me. You know, I'm never going to talk about anything else. And so, you know, I think that Jeb, landed there at the start. But, you know, I think when his wife was attacked, he definitely felt compelled to respond.
To subject my wife into the middle of a raucous political conversation was completely inappropriate. And I hope you apologize for that, Donald.
What do you think of the low energy moniker?
What did Jeb think about
it?
Jeb just didn't get it. You're right. I mean, he was just like, this is ridiculous. Like, this guy, like, sits around his New York high-rise in his pajamas, like, eating hamburgers and, like, flies in and does one event where he calls me low energy, and then he flies home and sends tweets. I mean, like, Trump is low energy, whereas Jeb, on the other hand, was living a life of, like, 20-hour days, you know, where he's... You know, sending me emails at 4 a.m. and sending me emails at midnight, right? And he's out there raising money, doing 3 or 4 events a day. So I don't know that it even clicked with him.
we've talked to a lot of people for this podcast who universally say that donors will come up during the course of a campaign, and because they've given money, assume that they get to offer bits of campaign advice. And so I'm assuming that there were a number of donors in the party that came to you guys with bits of a campaign advice about how to handle Donald Trump. What was the worst piece of advice?
I mean, we could have had probably 19 full-time staffers dedicated just to the donor advice. right. And my, but while I try to think about the worst piece of advice, the Jeb, something to note about Jeb is that the Jeb@Jeb.org email, he reads, right?
Okay.
He still reads, and he responds to, you know, regular people.
Well, that's how we should have tried to book him.
Yeah, that is exactly how you should have tried to book him. And so he was getting the advice directly from from these donors. And I would sit next to him in the car, and he would read me, like, some of the advice.
And what
was
the
getting.
Gist?
It was honestly sartorial was the biggest piece of advice. Like, these donors have a lot of thoughts about, like, his cable TV look. Donors are obsessed with cable TV. The most feedback we got was with regards to cable TV. Why aren't you on enough? When you are on, you know, why is he not wearing a suit coat rather than a sweater? Can he get a new suit coat jacket?
Is that why the glasses were taken off at some point? Were they upset with that?
I think the campaign, he looks better without glasses.
All right, fine.
Do you not think so?
The
glasses were taken off because they were really, like, foggy one day.
Okay.
Like, really foggy. And so he couldn't see, and he kind of took them off to clean them. And I was standing there with him. I just said, hey, just leave him off. Like, it's a cable interview. You don't need to be able to see, right? I mean, because his eyesight was terrible. So you're just looking into the blank camera.
You kind of want to see just in case.
A satellite TV
net? I don't know. Anyways, it's surprising to me that donors, I guess it's not surprising, but do they realize how small the universe of cable news watchers are? As someone who goes on cable news, like, it's my mom, basically.
No, they do not realize it. And as the communications director, while I'm grateful for all of the financial support we receive from across the country to any donors who are listening to Candidate Confessional, I would probably say 80 to 90% of the feedback I got directly or through Jeb was related to cable news. I think it's because it's just on in their offices all day.
Yeah. So do they have, like, suit recommendations or ties or...
Yes, all.
Really? So
yes.
They're like, he should be wearing a red tie.
Yes. We got specific feedback about
Joseph
colors.
Joseph A. Bank suits, red ties.
I don't know about brands. We did get specific feedback about colors and about, you know, whether he should be in studio or on satellite. And we received and then his mien when he was on cable TV. Most of the feedback was related to that. I'd have to go back and I wish you would have asked me this last night so I could have thought about it, because we got some really bad advice, but I can't think of anything funny right now.
Okay.
Do you regret not taking some of that advice on the suit choices? Or
I do not.
Okay. Elevating this a little bit, because it
I kind of regret taking their advice a little too much, honestly, with regards to, like, there is increased pressure to put people on TV because you hear about it so much. And, you know, I thought I wanted to blast out the email of the Rick Santorum surrogate hit on Marco Rubio to all of our donors who wanted us to have, you know, the biggest complaint about me was that we did not have surrogates on MSNBC.
You're going to need to explain. So the Rick Santorum surrogate hit was when he was asked to name a Marco Rubio accomplishment, couldn't come up with one.
And then the Rubio campaign had spent 3 days talking about how he didn't have any accomplishments.
And you could have told your donors at that point, see the downsides of
it. Right, and it was like a daytime MSNBC hit. There were no Republican primary voters watching.
That was a pretty bad one. To elevate this a little bit, though, it does seem like one of the big problems...
Do we have to elevate it?
A little bit. One of the big problems, it does seem, was there a huge collective action problem, right? Like, everyone wanted to be the last guy standing against Trump. And that meant that they didn't want to be the first guy to take him on one-on-one. Until your boss did. But, I mean, there were a few people before him, but your boss basically
another
did
one.
It. Rick Perry.
We were doing it before Rick Perry.
Okay, fine. Was there ever a time where the campaigns tried to have back-channel conversations at all to try to come up with some sort of comprehensive anti-Trump strategy?
The honest answer is that the back-channel conversations were mostly about beating one another, right? I think that for the longest time, everybody felt exactly how you just said, that the best play for each individual candidate, there was a collective action issue, each individual candidate's best play was to be the last person standing against Trump. And I thought Jeb, for example, was basically a shield for some of these guys on the debate stage, you know, and I understand it. If I was sitting in
a human shield, shall we say?
Yeah, he was a human shield, right? If I was sitting in the debate prep for any of the other candidates, I can't imagine that I would have been suggesting them, you know what you need to do is throw some punches at Donald Trump. You know, no, like let Jeb handle it. You know, he's the one who's taken all the incoming. And you saw what happened.
The United States by insulting your way to the presidency.
Well, let's see. I'm at 42 and you're at 3. So far, I'm doing better.
Doesn't matter.
So far, I'm doing better. You know, you started off over here, Jeb. You're moving over further and further.
Do other campaigns thank you after the debates?
No, no. We got no thanks. We got no recognition. All we got was a lot of uptick in Twitter trolls. But no, we got no recognition at all. And these other guys didn't do anything. And here is where the strategic mistake happened is of the other campaigns, in my opinion, is when Jeb really went at Trump in, I think it was the November debate. And he went at Trump about how he thought Hillary would be a good Secretary of State, and then we did ads on it. You remember the Super PAC ad was like, Jeb's the only one taking on Trump. The reason why we did that was from a process standpoint. We felt like it had reached the point where Trump had such a lead that all the other candidates were going to realize you could get free media from attacking Trump, and there was going to be a pile-on effect. And so, you know, we were saying internally, we need to go out and say this. Like, you know, Jeb might as well, if he's taking all the bruises, he might as well get credit for being the one who's taking on Trump. So at that point, that was about Thanksgiving, I thought that we need to take credit for it now because it was coming from all the other guys. It didn't come again for 3 months, and I think that really damaged, you know, Marco. I do not think that the problem for Marco was that, you know, he made the hands attacker, that it was childish. I thought that was overblown. The issue was that it wasn't credible. These guys had spent 9 months, and Cruz is running into that now. They'd spent 9 months, you know, sucking up to him, and now all of a sudden, you know, he's the worst person ever. There's a lack of credibility that comes with that attack, and so I do think the other guys needed to, I mean, it's most obvious thing ever, they need to do it earlier.
Yeah.
What was the strategy going into the debates, how to attack Trump? I mean, we talked to Newt Gingrich, and he thought that debating Trump was really, really impossible. He compared it to the bear and Revenant.
When you hit him, he devours you. He can't help himself. And so he creates an environment unlike anything I've ever seen.
Like, he thought it was really tough. And we asked him, like, would you attack Trump? And he said, no, I'd hope the other guys would do it.
Exactly. Well, and I think we had no choice. So, you know, I think while Jeb gets credit for doing it, at the same point, like, Trump was going to attack us regardless. So Jeb's only other choice was to try to take the high road. And, I don't think that was really viable. Our view on attacking Trump, I think if you watched the debates as they unfolded, was more that you had to act more like Trump. You know, Jeb was never going to act like Trump, you know, because their personalities are so different. But just in the sense of talking over him, you have to talk. Yeah, you have to get the last word.
There was
you have
one
to
debate where Trump
complimented
him being high energy, I believe, in one debate.
Yeah. And you have to keep pushing back, keep interrupting him, keep getting the last word. I think there was one debate where Jeb was like, "Ah, taste of your own medicine," when like Donald was complaining about Jeb interrupting him, and that was the best, you know, the strategy that we came up with.
The Obama campaign would often talk about this concept of being in the barrel, right? Which is essentially, if I'm defining it right, you're in a terrible news cycle and it's just endless and there's no apparent way out and whatever you do or try to do is not going to help. And I think it's fair to say that Jeb had that same thing too. So from the perspective of someone who's running his communications, what's that like?
Yeah, our version, my version of the barrel is I called it the angry mom syndrome, where, you know, if you get in trouble at school when you're in fifth grade and you come home and your mom is just angry and she says, I can't believe you did that, and there's nothing you can say. There's nothing you can say. You can try every possible answer, but you're in the barrel with the mom. And so we were that way with the press, where I kind of referenced this earlier, where we had these, you know, kind of fun, you know, videos showing Jeb's personal side, where at the beginning of the campaign, that was kind of like, oh, that's nice. It's different. It's kind of Jeb behind the scenes. But then when our poll numbers were at 4%, all of a sudden the self-deprecating humor became like sad and there was the pathos. So the hoodie thing is a good example. People who are not watching the podcast should go watch the hoodie video. It was just, we thought it was funny. Jeb was putting on a hoodie. He put it on completely the wrong way. It was like he'd never put on a hoodie before. And
do you think people were confused? They thought, like, he just doesn't know how to put on a hoodie.
Well, right. Well, so when it initially came out, there were a series of videos like that that people thought were funny. So did Lucia Graves work for Huffington Post?
She did.
Former HuffPost. Lucia Graves. Yeah. So she writes an article literally 9 months after the hoodie thing came out. I think she'd just seen it because it had regained virality on Twitter. And she wrote this really long article about all these sad videos on our website that showed poor Jeb. And I called her and I was like, Lucia, we put these videos out in June, right? Like, people liked them. Like, you just missed it, right? But, that's a stupid example of what it's like to be in the barrel, but it just shows that everything is seen by the press through the light of your poll numbers. And so, you know, the example at the end, I think the best example was Please Clap, right? Where Jeb was at an event in New Hampshire, and, you know, he goes on this really kind of long, wonky answer about policy. And at the very end of the thing, like, two people in the front, like, clapped really enthusiastically. And he kind of chuckles and looks at him, and it's like, no, go ahead, please, you know, please clap. And you know, that was grabbed on Vine by one of the embeds that were there, and it was cut down to just the please clap part. And it was seen as, like, encapsulating, you know, the sad part of this campaign that he had to beg for clapping. Now, imagine if Trump had done that, on the other hand, at the leading in the polls. And, you know, and Trump's up there, he's like, believe me, please clap, believe me, please. And, you know, like, people would think it's funny, right? And so, you know, all these little things that you do, they all get seen through the light of your poll numbers. And so,
how do you break out of that?
Get better poll numbers. I mean, honestly, there was no way.
Things you do get made fun of, which make your poll numbers worse.
Right. It was we were in the death spiral, which is kind of the other version of that. A guy on the Rubio campaign texted me about 4 days after Marco Roboto.
David, what was Rubio doing? Coming back to that answer five times, I think, in that exchange with Chris Christie.
And was like, it's so hard. Like, we can't do anything without getting insulted. And I've texted him. I said, well, welcome to since the 4th of July for me. Like, this has been 4 days for you guys. You know, kind of
he's like, you guys
put on your big boy pants here.
You guys can't deal with, like, two dudes in cardboard robot outfits?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We thought the best way from our perspective out of it was to take on Trump in the debates. And we thought the only possible way out of it was to get the better of him.
And we didn't.
But maybe there's somebody out there in Huffington Post podcast land that could come up with a better idea, but that was the best
one.
Was there
an individual low point in that process?
Well, for me, the low point was probably when it really was clear for me that it was going to be tough for Jeb to win was I was at my brother's bachelor party in New Orleans. I took 2 days off the campaign trail, and we had gone in the field with a poll, and I'd purposely not looked at it, like, over the course of the bachelor party because I didn't want to know. And there was one question in the poll that I was really interested in what the result was going to be. And the question was, what do you like least about Jeb Bush? And, you know, it was trying to get the sense of how can we sort of turn these folks. And so with a huge hangover at, you know, on Sunday morning, knowing I had to fly back to Miami, I looked down at the poll and I scrolled just to that question to see what the result was. Over 70% of voters said what they least liked about Jeb was something related to Bush or something related to nerdy, low energy, doesn't feel tough enough. And so to me, like, all the other stuff that everybody talked about, the immigration or Common Core, or the gaffes or 2%, none of that mattered at all. Our whole issue was related to dynasty or, you know, this sort of this tough factor, if you will. And none of that, neither of those things were fixable.
And when was this poll taken, roughly?
October. It was mid-October. So, you know, this was about 4 months out, and I just remember looking at that and thinking, I don't know how we're going to fix this.
That's 4 months out, and you basically have a fatalism about the campaign with months to go. So, I mean, maybe not fatalism, that might be a little off, but you know it's not going to go well, as you admitted.
Yeah.
How do you as a staffer get up every day and, like, get into work and have that hanging over your head?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough in the office in particular. It's better on the road. It was for me, at least. Maybe everybody kind of deals with this stuff differently. But, you know, especially when you're in New Hampshire, I think there's a way that you sort of buy into the sort of mystique here, right?
And everybody talk to enough voters.
Yeah, you talk to enough voters. Everybody knows you, you know, when you're walking around New Hampshire. So there's kind of a positive feeling on the ground with real people that does not exist sort of in the chattering class when your poll numbers are that low. The office vibe is a little bit tougher. So, I mean, you have to be mindful of that. I mean, I will admit it was probably not too long after that I had, you know, one of the younger staffers, you know, say to me on the campaign, like, you need to be mindful of how you're kind of carrying yourself around here, right? Because everybody looks to, you know, and these campaigns are full of young people. I mean, I'm 34, and, like, I was, like, the old guy, right? And so, like, they're looking to me for how I act. And I really appreciated him saying that because I, like, went in when I was in the office every day with the idea of, all right, let's go kick these guys' ass. And I think the best way to combat, you know, that sort of dark feeling is to go out there and throw punches.
I could care less about the insults that Donald Trump gives to me. It's blood sport for him. He enjoys it, and I'm glad he's happy about it.
But I am sick and tired
of him going after my family. My dad is the greatest man alive in my mind.
I thought that his best moment of the whole campaign, in my opinion, Jeb's best moment was when he went at Trump for attacking the disabled reporter. You know, and I thought that we really, you know, that was a good week for the campaign because you felt a lot. We had people coming to the events saying, you know, we turned into an ad. You know, I saw that ad on TV and I was hoping that somebody'd stand up to this guy. Like, that's so low, you know, for him to insult somebody for their disability. And we had a dude in South Carolina, Tim Dyer, who owned a barbecue shop, who called the campaign and was like, come down to the barbecue shop. We hosted an awesome event in his, in his barbecue restaurant in kind of rural South Carolina. The place was packed, and he gave a really emotional speech. He had a kid who had cerebral palsy kind of before he introduced Jeb. And so, you know, I think that sort of addresses both your questions, right? We felt like, A, that was the way to try to get at the toughness thing is to come at Trump from different ways and show strength. And B, you know, it also helped with the morale, right?
Yeah. But then I guess the other question that is related to those poll numbers is that, like, you know, we sort of think of campaigns as like these a series of very strategic events that, you know, you make decisions and then maybe, you know, that'll change the complexion of the race if you just sent this tweet or you just did different in this debate moment. But what those poll numbers suggest to me is that, by and large, you know, the landscape is pretty set on these things. And there's not much that campaigns can actually do to change fundamentals in a race. So to sum it up, is all this kind of bullshit?
Nothing matters.
Nothing matters. Yeah. I mean, but seriously.
I have two interesting things on this, if you'll allow me. One is I think that you know, for Jeb in particular, and that's why I'm kind of hesitant to when you ask me, you know, what staffer said this and what staffer said that. For us in particular, in this campaign, it really didn't matter. You know, and if you look at those numbers, you know, in one of the first postmortems, there was an anonymous staffer in Politico who said, you know, I had suggested in August that Jeb challenged Trump to a debate on O'Reilly where we take on the anchor baby issue and the low energy issue head on O'Reilly in August. And I just remember reading this and just laughing, right? And I called, I still don't know who said it, but I called Sally Bradshaw, who's his chief advisor, and Danny. I said, we need to tell people to stop saying this because this is ridiculous on its face. Like, the idea that the campaign trajectory would have changed based on one O'Reilly interview in August. I mean, just the fact that somebody thought that that was going to be the difference, I think just shows how ridiculous it is, right? Mm-hmm. To think that one or two tactical decisions would have made a difference. And, you know, and one of the nice calls I got after the campaign was from Joe Lockhart, who was the press secretary for Bill Clinton. And I'd worked for him at a PR firm in town. And he said to me, I hope you feel okay. And I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but I worked on four presidential campaigns, three losers. Mondale, Dukakis, Clinton won, and then Kerry. And he said, on Mondale and Dukakis, I finally realized after a couple of weeks that there was no sense being sad about this because I worked for guys that I respected and there was nothing I could have done. You know, there wasn't any strategic decision that Joe Lockhart could have done that would have made Michael Dukakis the president. He said the Kerry one was the tough one for me. You know, I spent, he said he spent a long time thinking about, is there anything we could have done? Like, that race was so close. So I think that I tell that story because I think that Joe was exactly right. You know, that there are strategic decisions that matter. It's not like nothing matters. There's certain things. I mean, and who knows with this Cruz and Trump thing, if we end up going to a delegate fight, which I expect, you know, maybe there really were, looking back on it, very important strategic decisions happening in the next 2 months in this delegate battle that made the difference between Trump and Cruz. But for us, you know, 11% in New Hampshire, 8% in South Carolina, I don't know that any of those things would have been the difference maker.
How long did it take you to recover after the...
Oh, yeah. You're not fully recovered.
I'm not. I didn't have a chance to recover. I spent a beautiful day, one beautiful 24 hours in Miami, where I went to the beach alone. I started to read a book. I've not read a book in like 18 months. I've read the first three chapters of a book and laid on the beach for like 8 hours.
Which Ayn Rand book was that?
it was Sarah Palin's book. And then we...
it was a Huckabee.
God,
Guns, Grips, and Gravy. Yeah.
What book was it, though? I'm curious.
I guess this is the point. I started to read 20 pages of it, and then I stopped. I can pull it up on my Kindle right now. But this is getting to where we're going the story. Then I went to the University of Miami basketball game. A big basketball fan. I went alone. I thought about asking if a campaign person wanted to come with me. I decided I didn't want to talk about the campaign. I sat alone on the beach. I sat alone at the basketball game. And then I did not cry. I woke up the next morning feeling fantastic. Then the next day, I went out with all the campaign kids. We got hammered till 5 in the morning. At 8:30 in the morning, I got a phone call from the anti-Trump super PAC guys who asked me to come help them, which is what I'm doing now. Our principal's PAC, putting in a plug for my current employer. And I felt like, number one, it was the right thing to do, was to go and, you know, fight Donald Trump and keep him from taking over this party. And number two, I don't know if there's ever this, it might be my life peak, was the 3 week period where I was paid to sit by the pool in Miami and send mean tweets at Donald Trump and go and do television hits where I said, or I attacked Donald Trump on cable TV.
You not
Miami.
Only did
That's
television hits,
job.
Though, you actually got in his face at a post-debate moment, I recall. Were you nervous about that? Or was it fine?
Twice, sorry, I got into his face after the debate. No, after the first debate, Jeb's last debate, which I thought Jeb got the better of him, when Trump said that he had stood by his comments that George W. Bush should be impeached, and he stood by his comments that he felt like Vladimir Putin is a great leader.
Remember how we thought that was going to end Trump's candidacy?
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. No. I followed Trump around the spin room, and every interview he did, I walked right up after him and just said, like, did he reiterate his support for George W. Bush's impeachment, and did he continue to suck up to Vladimir Putin? And you know, kind of Corey Lewandowski and his team sort of ended up boxing me out. No, I'm fine. No bruises. And then at the next debate, I saw Trump walking by. This is when I'm with the anti-Trump group, not with Jeb anymore. And we had an altercation where I asked him if he was wearing a Trump tie and if I could see where it was made. And then he walked three steps, turned around, recognized me from cable news because Trump does watch cable news all the time. Sam's mom, Trump, and dozens of other people watch daytime cable news. So he recognized me from cable news, and so he started shouting at me. I ruined Jeb's campaign. Then I was shouted at him about how he ruined Trump meets, and we kind of had a back and forth period of about, I don't know, 45 seconds.
Do you still talk to Jeb, and how's he doing?
He's doing great. Like I said, I think that he... you learn a lot about candidates when they lose. I've been on a number of losing campaigns. Some of them really get angry. Some of them kind of lash out and blame others. Jeb was really very much at peace with the campaign that he ran. So he moved back to Coral Gables, gets to spend time with his wife. That's a good life. I saw him. He had just been off the golf course when I saw him about 2 weeks ago. We email a little bit. You guys can email him, jeb@jeb.org. He has time now.
I will.
He seems to be doing well.
That was Tim Miller, Jeb Bush's former communications director, who graciously opened up about life on the campaign trail with Jeb in 2016. We took Tim's advice and we emailed Jeb at his email address, and he did get the email, but he declined an interview through another aide. Next week, we have famed women's reproductive rights advocate Sandra Fluke, who talks about what it was like to run for a state senate seat in California, which, naturally, she lost. Otherwise, she wouldn't be on this podcast. A huge thanks, as always, to Christine Canetta, who edited this podcast. It wouldn't be the same without her. You can find Candidate Confessional on iTunes or on thehuffingtonpost.com, and we encourage you to tell literally everybody, complete strangers, the barista at Starbucks, tell them to subscribe to the show, rate it, and review it. Until next week, dear listener, happy trails.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.